next time we see each other, maybe years and years from now. Family reunion, got to have a family reunion. Family reunion, it's so nice to come together, get together. I wish Grandma could see the whole family. I sure miss her face and a warm and tender.
You're listening to Lead Stories on PRN.FM. That's the OJs with Family Reunion, the title track from their 1975 album. I'm Eutrice Lead. It's Friday, March the 27th, and we are going to give a shot at a Free Your Mind Friday. We've been boggled with and attacked by the gremlins of technology, and but we will muddle through. And I'm so delighted to be able to join with you again. And we've had a kind of a dry spell. We haven't been able to talk with each other and do the customary banter that leads to great conversation and great exchange of information, opinions, and ideas. And I'm hoping that we will do that today, starting today. We have also to make up for lost time, so we will be scheduling more of these sessions to just make up for the Free Your Mind Friday sessions that we have missed, as well as the ability during regular shows to communicate with each other. The good news is that PRN is moving to new studios. Of course, it's right now we are moving to temporary new studios and then to the permanent new studios. So there's a lot of things going on. And on my end, I have to do some upgrading as well, but we'll talk about that another time. But 888-874-4888 is a number to call, 888-874-4888. If you have called before, you know, well, we haven't talked for a long time, so it's open. Everybody can just call in and we take you as you file in on the phones. There's so much to catch up on. There's so much news to talk about. There's a lot going on. And, of course, we all are subjected to the reports of the major media telling us what to think, telling us what is news. But, of course, the whole exercise here is to come to our own conclusions based on what we think and what we feel and what we know. And in exchanging these ideas, we actually engage in one of the most important uses, I think, of radio, which is that people educate each other through discourse and very respectful exchange of information and ideas. And I think that is one of the best uses of media, to bring people together and to encourage the cross-pollination of ideas so that we don't all fall victim to the notion that whatever it is CNN says is the news, in fact is the news. We know that there are all kinds of angles, all kinds of unsaid things that should be explored, that add dimension to what we know as news or what we are told as news. So all of this helps. It's self-education. So I value that as one of the most important aspects of radio. It brings people together who, by virtue of their experience, by virtue of just the way they look at life, the things that have shaped their lives, their consciousness, their individual attention to detail and education, their self-education, these things are valuable assets. And we need to, you know, place more emphasis on this aspect of using radio to bring people together. So all of that said, let me also say that I so appreciate the patience of the audience. We've suffered through quite a few glitches, but it's, you know, it's just what it is, and we will muddle through. But I really appreciate the fact that you are continuing to support PRN and Lead Stories. And in this regard, I'm going to be mounting a special rebuilding campaign. We have to rebuild the program, and we have to rebuild the audience. And that means I'm asking each of you, because you are diehard listeners, to reach out to at least 10 people in your circle and let them know that we are on the rebound and we are getting back to normal as close as possible, as close to it as possible. So I'm asking that we rebuild Lead Stories, and not that it's fallen apart, but we did have quite a few glitches, and a large part of it is people thinking, well, I don't know whether if it's going to happen or not today, but we are fine. We're getting back on solid ground. So I need your help in that regard. I see on the Facebook page we passed 500, well, almost more than half a million downloads of the podcast of the program. So that means that people are listening. But frankly, I mean, we haven't done a major campaign, an outreach campaign, and telling people, getting really excited and exercised about drawing more and more people into our circle. So I want to do that and to expand the reach of the program, but also to expand the participation in the program. So that would be a major thrust for me. But in the meantime, it's about you. 888-874-4888. And we'll take the first call. Hello, you're on the air.
Hey, how you doing, you Trace?
Fine, thanks.
This is Henry from Chicago.
Oh, my goodness. Hello, Henry. How are you?
I'm doing good. I'm doing good. So nice to talk to you again.
Same here. Missed you dearly. You know, I thank you for that wonderful piece you wrote me on the state of affairs in Chicago. Perhaps you could give us an update on what's going on from your perspective.
Yes, I wanted to kind of fill in the gaps because you did bring some interesting and good perspective from where you see the Chicago mayoral election. You mentioned on your first piece, I think you did last week, in regards to that, about how Rahm took a lot of the black districts in the February 25th voting primaries in Chicago. And one of the big reasons was because blacks in the city didn't vote. I mean, there was less than 30% turnout in the black community because, you know, the thing about it in Chicago, in black Chicago, is that when they feel that they don't have a candidate that they want to vote for, they just don't vote. And Chewy is kind of gaining steam now. He seems to be picking up a little bit. And I think I mentioned to you in the email that, as well as, you know, you had mentioned about how the, you know, quote unquote black leaders here was late to the bandwagon. Chewy kind of came in late as well, trying to, you know, garner the black vote, because in this election, that's probably what's going to determine who's going to be mayor, because obviously Rahm has majority of the white votes. And Chewy has majority of the Latino votes here in Chicago. And typically it's almost 30-30-30, you know, 30-33, you know, in regards to the racial makeup of Chicago. So the black vote is gonna basically determine who's gonna be mayor. And Chewy does seem to be gaining steam in the black community. I still feel if the election happened tomorrow, Rahm might still get it. Just for the simple fact that, I guess, gauging from the voters here in Chicago, they still seem to feel a little, I guess, out of touch with Chewy, and they're still, I guess, they're still I guess there's still some sort of, you know, reluctance to, you know, to vote for Chewy because of the fact that he hasn't done enough outreach. But like I said, he has been doing it a little bit more. The other day, they did a forum at Chicago State University here in Chicago. Now, Chicago State University is predominantly African American university, and generally it was he did answer a couple of questions pertaining to the black vote and the black community. However, one thing that kind of bothers me, and this is both with Chewy and Rahm, is that neither one of them has addressed the issue of police brutality here and the racial profiling here within, you know, the Chicagoland community. I don't know if you or any of your listeners know about the site that was discovered here in Chicago at Holman Square, and it was basically a site where Chicago police for years have been illegally detaining.
Site, as they call it.
Black site. Yes, and who had been illegally detaining suspects and torturing them. In this particular site at Holman Square, and neither one of them has addressed that issue, which, you know, kind of concerns me heavily on that one. And then also, too, with the recent ACLU report about how racial profiling here in Chicago is even more prevalent than in New York and in Philadelphia. So hopefully in the next debate, especially with Chewy, because, you know, I'm really pulling for Chewy, but at the same time, you know, the black community really needs to make some kind of political connection with them. I understand we need to get rid of Rahm. That is an essence here to help Chicago. But at the same time, we just can't hang our hat on that particular theme. You know, we have to.
I appreciate what you're saying. My point was, and still is, that the race is on, and there are all kinds of substantive issues that need to be addressed. But from the perspective that I came from was, what, therefore, is the mandate of the black leadership, the Latino leadership, the grassroots leadership in the situation? It is far from perfect. Chewy Garcia came late, and we know why. To the race, but at the same time, is there a general agreement? Could there at least generally agree that Rahm Emanuel, another term of Rahm Emanuel, is going to be disastrous? And if so, what therefore can they do in the time that they have to construct a viable alternative candidacy with Chewy Garcia to shore him up so that the first major task is accomplished, which is to get him out of City Hall, get Rahm Emanuel out of City Hall. And then secondly, of course, they'll have to dance all over the place. They'll have to dance on both sides of the fence. They'll have to put on many hats and do all kinds of things all at the same time because, frankly, they haven't been doing this work on an ongoing basis. Mm-hmm. The Latino community, the African-American community, the leadership has not been doing its work in maintaining, you know, a constant engine so that at any given time when the opportunity arises, there's some apparatus in place to carry the weight of the will of the people. So this is my point about leadership. The black leadership came late to this whole thing because they were, of course, firmly enmeshed with the Democratic Party and Obama, i.e. Rahm Emanuel. And they took the position in the first round to go with Rahm because of those allegiances. Now, an opportunity arises. You have a viable candidate who has done a historic thing, forcing a runoff. It is first time in Chicago history, which means that with all the problems that are swirling around it, okay, the fact is that there is an expression of a need for change. What, therefore, is the task of the leadership? That's the question.
Yes, and you're right, because here's the thing, because if you talk to a politically astute person, they will tell you, yes, Rahm needs to go, and they'll give you the reasons why. I mean, Rahm actually should be in jail for some of the stuff that he's done in City Hall. But to the point, what the black leadership needs to do, along with Chewy, is we need to get to the voters who are the ones that are stuck in the middle, who are, you know, still Obamaites, but they've seen, they're kind of opening their eyes to what's going on. That's one of the big reasons why Rahm didn't win, you know, in the primary, the outright election, because of the fact that people are starting to open their eyes. Now, here's the thing. We have to, you know, in the next week or so, we have to, you know, try to wake them up a little bit more, because people are kind of still on the fence. And those swing votes, you know, within the black community is still kind of like, they're still on the fence. That's why I'm saying Chewy has to have a much bigger presence, hopefully in the next couple of weeks, you know, hopefully in the next week or so, to get those swing votes in the black community, because I feel it's still kind of teetering to Rahm. But, you know, if he can make a good push in the next week, you know, I can feel a big win for Chewy.
I hope so. And thank you so much. I really enjoyed your email, and you made such great points. But this is something that we ought to look at beyond the mayoral race as well. Whether Chewy Garcia actually wins or doesn't win, in my view, he has already won in the sense, not just him personally. The whole idea of a resurgence of a grassroots movement is itself a big victory, because there's so much disincentive. You know, the Democratic Party is like in Chicago is the behemoth, the juggernaut. It just rolls over everybody. But here we see the beginnings of resistance and a reawakening, and that's extraordinary, an extraordinary accomplishment via his candidacy. Thanks so much for calling. Great to hear from you. This is Lead Stories on PRN.FM, 888-874-4888. Hello, you're on the air.
Hello?
Yes, you're on the air.
Hello, Eutrice. This is Joel from New York.
Hello, Joel. How are you?
It's really nice to hear your voice again and to hear the voice of the entire little commonwealth that we've got going here.
And
Thank you so much.
To see. I missed everybody. I hope everybody missed the program, too.
Oh, yeah. Well, I listened in. And I must say that I was particularly appreciative of the three programs you did with Professor Lumpkins. That was really good. I mean, it's not very often that we learn about the connection between the African-American experience in this country and the labor wars. So I thought that was excellent. And I think sometime in the future, even though it was a very, very comprehensive series of discussions that you had with him, there were a few things that I wanted to add to the story, but I think I'll do that, you know, another time.
Well, actually, he's due back just to take questions, and we scheduled him just to come back and have his time with the listeners. Yes.
That's excellent. So I'll call up, and hopefully I'll get through. Before the fascistic assault on the station, I had read something in The Guardian about a month ago and wanted to bring it up, but then we had our, you know, hiatus or interregnum. So I think I kind of would like to talk about it now, because I read about it in The Guardian back in January, and nobody has really talked about it since. I haven't seen anything in the mainstream media, and even in the alternative media, I haven't seen much about this at all. And yet, what I'm about to talk about now is so expressive of the lack of humanity of Western governments, of their utter disregard for human life. And what I'm getting at is that the article I read stated that there is no money left for Syrian refugees, that, you know, the refugees that were created by the civil war that was fomented and fanned for years on end by Western governments, by the way, bizarrely, then prosecute any of their citizens who go off to fight in the war their governments promote as a noble, worthy cause. And for want of about $64 million, which is, I guess, the amount of money that the U.S. spends in an eye blink in its drone campaigns and death squads, you know, the kind of money that's just chump change for, say, oligarchs who prowl the world, destabilizing governments, monetizing misery for their own pockets. For $64 million, for the want of $64 million, the UN says it must halt a vital support program for Syrian refugees. And what is happening there is really sickening and surreal. And none of the public discourse surrounding this vast, this vile slaughterhouse has addressed this issue. Now, it's clear to, I think, to most of us that the Western public are really tiring of these wars, these Muslim wars, but governments are tiring of their victims. So the UN apparently has run out of money to relieve the refugee tide. That's now spreading across the region. And some 4 million people are living in camps that are reliant on the UN's World Food Program, not to mention, you know, the camps, other camps caused by wars in Sudan and Somalia and Central African Republic. And 1 million Syrians in the last year have fled to Lebanon and 1 million to Jordan. So you've got these new desert cities of indolence and disease. And now the cash vouchers that supply liquidity to these camps and sustain food supplies are to end. And in the article that I read, I learned that some $500 million had been pumped into the Jordanian camps by the UN alone, and now the money has run out. And food rations are going to be cut. Host governments facing what looks like a ceaseless human migration are starting to close their borders. That means that the resources that these people need are seizing up. Now, the U.S., Britain, and NATO played a major part in disrupting the region. You know, they indulged in their wars of choice in Serbia and Afghanistan, Iraq and Libya. And for a decade, they toppled regimes and either fought or backed insurgents with bombs and troops, but they didn't bring any peace. There will always be money for military action. We're seeing that again. Our country spent $3 trillion fighting in Iraq. Britain spent some £40 billion in Afghanistan alone under the obscene rubric of humanitarian intervention. So let the refugees die. Who cares? You know, the main thing is that the war goes on in Syria, in Iraq, in Somalia, in Afghanistan, where the hell ever. Who cares? None of these nations matter. None of these people matter. Obama, Cameron, Hollande, and the rest of them, they know that their policies are simply creating more terrorists, more extremism, more violence, more repression. They know this. Utrecht, all of them, across the entire political class, they know it, but they do not care. So you know what I say? Let's return this disregard to them. Let us not care what happens to them. Let's not fret about which team of murderers or moral idiots is going to win the next election. We already know who will win, the profiteers of death and domination. So I think it's quite astonishing that we don't hear anything about this whatsoever.
What, therefore, do you think is a workable plan of action?
Well, you mean with regard to feeding these desperate people?
And of course, reining in the actions of the Western nations, the Western governments that are causing the problem.
You know what? I've lost a tremendous amount of faith in our Western elites and Western governments, because behind everything is the desire to bring about this kind of neoliberal restructuring of the Middle East. I mean, everybody knows that the United States, or anybody who wants to know, knows that the United States trained and armed these jihadist irregulars in Jordan, along the Jordanian-Syrian frontier, and in Turkey. And everybody knows that behind everything is the desire to get rid of all of these secular governments in the Middle East. And, of course, the Assad government has to go. So behind all of their diplomatic approaches, I think, lies this rather cynical desire to still remake the region in their image. I really believe that when the neoconservatives approach the Democrats first, they approach people like Gore first with their project for a new American century vision, overthrowing seven governments in the Middle East. I believe that that vision is still there and well and alive in Washington. We certainly see it in the Ukraine. And frankly, the difference between the neoliberals and the neoconservatives, I think it's just an academic point. Both of them are dangerous, and both of them seem to be exemplars for the principle of American hegemony. So I think I'm going to say something rather a little odd right now. I think we need to reach out to the women of the Middle East. I really do, because every poll that I've seen in the Middle East suggests that it is women of all classes in all kinds of society who are deeply disturbed by the constant killing that is going on. And they could be a force for peace. And just like we need a grassroots radical political movement here, I think we need it in diplomacy as well. And maybe then we can see some kind of at least the beginnings of a resolution to this terrible tragedy.
Women who have been fulfilling that role from the West point of view, you know, have been women who epitomize the very thing that you're complaining about.
Oh, I don't mean
about
those women, you Trace. I don't mean those women. I'm thinking of the women who appear, not those women, like Hillary Clinton and Victoria Nuland and the rest of those witches, which is what they are. By the way, I keep thinking of Shakespeare and the three witches, because they are paramount in this administration. The three witches being Susan Rice, Victoria Nuland, and Samantha Power. And I recently read Samantha Power's book, and I would urge others, you know, Humanitarian Intervention, to take a look at that, because it really should be titled Humanitarian Imperialism. And I think that she has bloodlust, but she hides it in this notion of liberal interventionism, this concept of the right to protect. No, I don't mean them at all. I mean people like the women of Bilin, the Palestinian village, which every Friday there are demonstrations, peaceful demonstrations against the occupation and against the wall every Friday in the village, and they're run by women, and they're met usually with tear gas and sometimes rubber bullets. Of course, we don't hear anything about that, but stuff like that goes on all over the Middle East, and somehow I think that we need to mobilize these people, and we need a people's diplomacy, and I think that the women of the region would be the would provide wonderful leadership for this kind of grassroots.
I like the idea that you just said there. I love that idea of the people's diplomacy, because the people have good common sense.
That's right. And meanwhile, Utrice, yeah, we have all of these millions of people in the Middle East whose food supplies are running out, and the governments don't seem to care. You know, as I said before when I gave my little rant, they're more than willing. The Western governments are more than willing for the amount of money that would be needed to feed these people who are in dire straits right now. It's chump change for them. And it represents the kind of money that they throw into their drone attacks to their operations that are occurring in all of these places. But that doesn't seem to concern them whatsoever. Because the problem with these elites, and we've said this again and again, is that even though they seem to show a sensitivity to the publics that they represent, they really don't. They care little or nothing about human life. The only thing that's of concern to them is the policy. And the policy is predicated on dominion. It's predicated on controlling markets and plundering resources. If people have to die in that process, so be it. So we have to inaugurate a people's campaign, and I'm calling for the women of the Middle East to unite ordinary women in the Middle East and say enough of this.
Thank you so much, Joel, for your call today and for your very profound thoughts. Thank you so much for your call. 888-874-4888. This is Lead Stories. I'm Utrice Lead, and you are on the air.
Good afternoon, Utrice, and good afternoon to the PRN audience. This is Patricia calling from New York.
Hello, Patricia. How are you?
Oh, Utrice, I am so much better today. I feel as though I have been in an intellectual drought, not being able to communicate with the PRN audience and yourself. I feel as though I have been under attack here and feeling quite isolated and alone.
Oh, well, we're solving that today, I hope.
Yes, we are. And, you know, you're always asking the question, where do we go from here? And I wish I had good news to report today. And I'm going to give you three examples. As you know, as our PRN audience knows, our beloved scholar and teacher, Dr. Ben, passed away over a week ago. Well, in New York last week, the same week that Dr. Ben passed away, an ABC news person suffered, a young woman, 49 years old, married with two small children, suffered a massive brain aneurysm and passed away after reporting on a story. It was just, you know, just one of those tragic, you know, things that happened. And so this past Sunday, as you know, across the country on Sunday mornings, there are all these talk shows directed at the African-American community. So I tend to listen to them, and I call in and share some words of wisdom that I glean from you and your audience. And I try. I do my best, because I think the only way you can start a progressive movement is to share information with the masses. And unfortunately, on Sunday mornings, these shows have a captive audience of people of across the country, nationwide and locally, and so they are able to shape the information that these people are given, and hence their view of the world. So I'm listening to this show this past Sunday morning, and they open by expressing their condolences to the local ABC network and this anchor's family. So I'm waiting for them to talk about Dr. Ben, because I actually called in expecting that the entire show would have been on the work of Dr. Ben, and not a word. So, as you know, I called in, and I said, you know, this anchor is not the only person who passed away this week. Our revered scholar and teacher, Dr. Ben, passed away this week. So I'm expecting a response in response to my statement. Absolutely nothing. And it just, I almost felt as though it was an assault on African people throughout the diaspora, that they were just absolutely silent. You know, I mean, they went on literally for 15 minutes about this anchor who just happens to be Caucasian, that probably nobody even knew about it unless you watch ABC News, and why they felt that her death, you know, had to be elevated to this level. I just don't know. But all I could say is, who are you people? Who are you? That you would denigrate your own, that you would elevate this woman over your own. And so I said, oh, my God, that was one example. The other example, when you talk about African-Americans not being able, so connected to the Democratic Party that they cannot see the forest for the trees, I have the fortune to travel to Cuba. I just got back from Cuba. And I traveled with a group of middle-class African-Americans, mostly out of Queens, mostly out of this big, huge church in Queens that if you're in the New York area, you're quite familiar with, a behemoth church of African-Americans. And we were talking about the upcoming election in 2016, and I just happened to mention the fact that I hope African-Americans do not fall in line, lock, stock, and barrel behind Hillary Clinton, and you would have thought I had asked for their most prized child. Because the barrage, and I mean intense barrage, here we were sitting in a square in Havana drinking coffee and talking about political American politics, and you would have thought that we were talking about the Cuban Missile Crisis of the 1960s. I mean, I was attacked front and back, up and center. What do you mean? What do you mean you're not going to vote for Hillary? What do you mean? Aren't you going to vote? I said, yes, I'm going to vote, but I always vote the person, not the party. I'm not wedded to the Democratic Party. I can't think of anything that the Democratic Party has done for black and brown. Well, what's your alternative? What are you going to do? And the conversation went to a level, Utrecht, that I cannot begin to describe. And so finally, I just had to cut the conversation, because I recognized that I had touched a nerve. Now, she asked the question, then what is your solution? And you know something? And the question you ask all the time, where do we go from here? I didn't have an answer. And that disturbed me. I didn't have an answer.
The situation was so overwhelming, you were discovering the depth of at which people are just irrational, in my view. They're just irrational in their allegiances to parties that do nothing for them. And they have fallen for this very carefully concocted narrative, which, you know, puts Hillary Clinton on a pedestal. And nobody, I mean, it is hard to go into the African-American community and have a rational discussion about this. This is really extraordinary.
Because I tried to use your show as an alternative for information. I said, well, you know, Monday through Friday, 1 to 2 p.m., I am in communicado. You can't talk to me because I'm listening to you three sleep. And so I began to describe the show, and I began to describe the information, and the person's response to me was, well, I don't want to listen to somebody who's just going to be negative all the time. I said, but she's not being negative. She's providing you with information that you won't get anywhere else to give you an alternative to the information that's filling your head every day. And they rejected. They would not even be willing. They were not even willing to say, "Okay, I'll listen to one show and come to my own conclusion."
No, there has been, and of course, this was documented all the way back in the 1960s in the 1967 commission, Kerner Commission report on the state of what was causing all these uprisings across America. And the media came in for a huge pummeling by this commission. And they blamed the media for actually not just maintaining, but in some cases creating this schism in America, where, as I said, it contributed to two Americas, one white, one black, separate and unequal. And the role of the media in maintaining this inequality is about informational disfranchisement. You relegate people who are targeted for second-class citizenship, and you keep them in that space by just either refusing to cover the issues that are important to them, or you cover issues that convey a very negative idea about their humanity, their very humanity. So they've done that very, very well. ABC News in New York City, for example, is in complete violation even of the right to serve the community through public affairs programming. It is in violation of it. And as are most of the major media outlets, they are required by law to set aside time to talk about issues that relate to African Americans and Latinos and other so-called minority groups. But they don't do it. You may recall that Like It Is, which was a very, very important program, a necessary reference point in New York City, hosted by the late Gil Noble, Gil Noble's program was, you know, at any given time it would be replaced with a sports game of some sort. Or, literally, after he died, the program was changed to something called Here and Now, which stresses culture and entertainment rather than substantive issues that pertain to the community locally and nationally. So we have that as an example in which, in the stark reality of this huge population in the metropolitan market of African Americans and Latinos, you have the stations refusing to comply with the law to provide public affairs programming, and that is a deliberate act. So, and that is why you know more about the young woman who suffered an aneurysm while covering a story than you do about Dr. Ben Yohanan. In any event, Dr. Ben had been widely castigated by media, as have most major black scholars. recall the virulent attacks against Dr. Clark, Dr. Leonard Jeffries, and others who were doing the work of retrieving the missing pages of African-American history, and also placing Africa and the African diaspora within, you know, reach of people who had no idea about the centrality of Africa to all civilization. So there was a virulent attack in the world of academia, in the media, in policy making, and so forth. So all of these things combine to give us the view that not much at all has changed since the Kerner Commission report cited the media as creating this racial bifurcation of America and two Americas that are both separate and unequal. No question about that. What do we do? Because even, I must say, coming from the black press, the black press, too, is not doing its job. And the black press very often mimics the same focus and the same concerns as the establishment, as the government. You know, I will be talking next week about the coincidence, I'm going to leave it at that as a word, coincidence, between this National Urban League report that basically pronounced racism not the problem in America anymore, but income inequality, and the very coincidental speech by Hillary Clinton less than a week saying that the big issue is income inequality. You see, when we have our institutions being used this way as for strategic advantage and for a whole different agenda that has nothing to do with the welfare of the people, you find that the media is playing a major role in all of it. So your disturbing experience is a story about the relationship between media, propaganda, and control of the black community.
I hear you, and I think what I found most distressing was that when provided with an alternative for the information, these people were just not even willing to listen and hear. That I found most distressing. It's one thing if you don't know where the outlets are to get, you know, information, but when that information is shared with you and you just shut the door, that I found very distressing. But I thank you, and I am so.
A good friend of mine, Clinton Coxley, the writer and author and former reporter, called that intentional ignorance, the insistence on not knowing. And
What did you call that?
Intentional ignorance. When people just insist on being ignorant. Because to learn the truth about anything is so threatening. So they intentionally become ignorant. So I will never forget that phrase that he coined, and it stays with me to this day. He says, this is intentional ignorance, when people absolutely dedicate themselves to not knowing. They don't want to know.
I had never heard of that term, and I will now blazon that in my mind. But just one more thing, to remind the PRN audience that Ramsey Order has a court date on Monday, this coming Monday, March the 30th at 9 a.m. in Staten Island Supreme Court.
Yes. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
And thank you. Great to hear from you. Thanks so much, Patricia, for your call. 888-874-4888. This is Lead Stories on PRN.FM. You're on the air.
Hello. Hello, Eutrice. How are you?
Fine, thank you.
Good. This is DX from Los Angeles.
Of course it's DX, because you're the last caller.
Oh, yes. You always end up winding it up with me, right? So
how do you arrange this? What is the science?
It's called impeccable timing. No.
Well, you're bringing up the rear today, so you're under a slight crunch of time. but you have enough time to lay out your thoughts.
I had some pretty simple thoughts today. It's not that complex. First of all, I wanted to say that I am so enjoying this, that you're back up and running, and I'm getting to hear from my brothers and sisters. And greetings to all of them, and greetings to you, teacher. But one thing's missing, you trees. I don't know about the rest of the people listening, but I need Sarah from Dallas to call in.
I need Sarah
to call in. Come on, Sarah, we need you. We need you to kick in.
Well, we'll have more days, of course, so everybody will have a chance to reconnect.
Right.
So we've got to talk. We have to talk with each other.
Right. So I wanted to kind of just add to the conversation that was already occurring. I think that you guys were touching on a second ago what I always harp on, and that's propaganda in the media. But I think it's more than just propaganda, in quotes, as we think of it. I think it's more like programming, because there are a few subjects, especially in the black community, that if you want your head taken off and you want people to really not like you, you bring them up. So I'm a troublemaker. So one of the subjects I bring up when I'm in around black friends and things like that is religion. Now, as you know, Dr. Yosef Ben Yochanan was he was a Jew, but he wasn't your conventional Jew. He didn't agree with the Jewish establishment, and especially the European structure of government in Israel, and he spoke out against that very, very eloquently. And he more was into the origins of Judaism, Islam, and Christianity being all originating from Africa. So when you try to present some of this information to, I'll just use the term, black people in general, you immediately get a shutdown, and they look at you like you're from outer space. And I think it's more programming, and it's fear, because people who were raised to believe in that Bible, they fear anything new coming in, and so there's a blockage going on there. And they don't want to hear. And politics is the same way. They just fear any new information. Because I was raised in the South, Baptist, reading the Bible three times a week, going to Bible study, going to church on the weekends. And it very much is a culture of, this is all you have here. So when that's embedded into you for years and years, sometimes 30, 40, 50 years, it's very scary knowing new information, because it can rock your whole foundation. And so this is where these people are coming from when it comes to politics as well. So I just wanted to put my two cents in on that. I know you have to go. And
we have about 2 or 3 minutes left.
Oh, okay. Well, I just feel that, let me tell you about this last weekend. I went to Las Vegas, to meet up with a friend of mine from Chicago I hadn't seen in about 10 years, and his cousin, who is also from the Los Angeles area. And whenever I'm in a situation with people where we have some time together, I try to share ideas. And these guys, one of them is around my age. The other one's a little younger than the two of us. So we're sitting in the hotel room, and I'm trying to present a little bit of information, just slowly, not trying to beat them over the head with it or anything like that. And the conversation digressed from the situation, the political situation, and who's in the race and who isn't, and who'd you vote for, and all this type of stuff. It digressed from there into the latest shoes by Jordan. I mean, by LeBron, basketball shoes, and some other stuff about a viral video going around with some old lady dancing in it. So my point with that is, people have mechanisms set up in them where they don't really want to discuss this stuff, and they don't really, they're afraid sometimes. So we need techniques to where we can introduce new information to people more effectively and make them interested in it. And I think part of it is, too, that especially with the younger people, these types of discussions that we have, they're not exciting enough or something, because they've been so programmed that you need sensory overload in order to enjoy something, that some of that needs to be combated against. And I think we need new techniques in order to reach these people, is what I'm saying.
Great point. Well, thank you for your call, and thank you for performing your task of bringing up the rear.
I'm always here to help you, Tree. have a great weekend.
Thank you so much. And that brings us to the end of our program today. I so enjoyed the connections and reconnections with your friends and listening to their fantastic and profound ideas and opinions and instruction. And this is why radio exists, to bring us together in a community of ideas. Stay tuned. Coming up next is Wake Up Call with Richard Martin. You want to reach me, I hope, at leadstories@gmail.com and on Facebook, Lead Stories with Utrecht Lead. Remember, we are rebuilding, and this program has got to just grow and grow and grow. And I ask that you reach out to at least 10 people you know and let them know that we're back, and we're going to be stronger than ever and far more militant than ever. We're going to be a militant program, just aggressively deconstructing these notions that have held up for so long and looking under the rocks and finding out all of those creepy, crawly things that have been existing under there for so long. Thank you so much for your support and for your love of this program. It is a joy to me to connect with you each and every day. Always, as I say, a pleasure and a really great privilege to be in your esteemed company. Take care of yourselves over the weekend, rest up a little bit, and we come back to each other on Monday, God willing, and the creek don't rise. Bye-bye.